Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Welcome to Going In Blind. I'm your host, Zach Tidwell, and I think today's probably about to be a fire hose of information. My guest today has probably the most extensive list of titles that I've ever seen, at least for guests coming on here. She is the director of the Emory Healthcare Veterans Program at Emory School of Medicine. She's the associate vice chair of clinical research at the Emory School of Medicine in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences, and also the director of the Trauma and Anxiety Recovery Program, amongst about a million other things. So hopefully I've done her a little justice here, but I'm sure we will delve into much more of her work, including her past almost 40 years researching PTSD treatments and the treatment modality that she has invented and also pioneered in applying to treating combat veterans. But before we get into all of that, just a couple quick announcements. If you're new to the show, you probably don't know, but like many of my guests, I have a pretty powerful story myself, and I've seen that sharing it over the past several years does save lives. So in addition to speaking engagements and things like that, I've also written a memoir about it all to hopefully show people that there is always a way forward in some of the other nasty areas of life that are navigable, even though sometimes they don't seem like they are. So if you want to see a little bit about that story, you can head over to my website at zachtidwell.com and also join my mailing list there, so that when I'm done working with my editor and this thing does actually finally make it to publishing, you can get announcements about all that, because I don't have a definitive timeline right now, but hopefully here in the next year. Also, these are very impactful conversations that can be in a tremendous amount or source of help for people. The best way to help this show grow and make sure that those conversations get out there is to leave a rating and review wherever you're listening and share these things around. And finally, if you like to listen to your pod or watch your podcast instead of just listening, you can head over to YouTube and see my ugly mug and probably maybe a couple big-eyed facial expressions from my guest today as I inevitably ask a stupid question or two. But without any further ado, please welcome Dr. Barbara Rothbaum.
Thank you, Zach. I'm very pleased to be here.
Yeah, I'm so excited that we were able to connect. This was just, honestly, I was kind of overwhelmed by the list of credits in your bio. It just almost didn't know where to delve into things here, because you've accomplished so much over the years and in your work and are continuing to do so. So maybe, I know you've in recent history here have written a book about PTSD for the general public. Maybe we start there with you explaining what that is in terms that the general public can understand, and then we can start diving into what you're doing at the Emory Healthcare Veterans Program. And I really want to be able to dig into this VR application for exposure therapy too.
That sounds great. So I'll start with trauma. I've never want to forget that we are animals and we live in a dangerous world. And probably about 70% of us will be exposed to a potentially traumatic event in our lifetime. But that doesn't mean that 70% of us end up with PTSD. The way that I see PTSD is that someone is haunted by something that happened to them in the past. And the haunting nature comes out in re-experiencing symptoms, flashbacks, nightmares. Very often the person with PTSD, their world gets more narrow because a lot of times they're scared. The world feels very threatening. A lot of times they report being emotionally numb, that they know they love their kids. They know they're sad when someone gets a cancer diagnosis, but they don't really feel it. And so obviously this affects relationships. So in a word, having PTSD sucks. It really does. But the good news, and we're going to talk a lot about today, is we do have good treatments. So first, if I can, I want to talk a little bit about how I think the PTSD develops. Because like I said, most of us will be exposed to a potentially traumatic event in our lifetime, but most of us don't end up with PTSD. And I think that's because we emotionally process it. I make a lot of analogies to the grief process. And when something bad happens to us, there's no way to the other side of the pain except through it. But for example, when we lose someone we love and we grieve, we cry, we're around other people that lost them, it can eventually become less painful. It'll always be sad. We'll always miss them. But maybe 6 months down the road, we can think about them without crying. For various reasons, I think sometimes people don't emotionally process a traumatic event. For example, somebody's in a combat zone. You don't want to have a big reaction. You want to do what you're trained to do. And sometimes people never put that human and emotional reaction back where it should be. Other people are just avoidant. It hurts. It's painful to process it. And so they push it away. So we think that avoidance is how PTSD develops. And then the counter to that is what we do a lot of is exposure therapy. It's approaching that traumatic memory and triggers, but in a therapeutic way so that it gets easier.
And can I pause? I want to pause here because a couple of things came up.
Yes.
It's really interesting. And so I don't know if you know this, I'm a Marine Corps veteran. I was a machine gunner. I'm not a combat veteran, but I lost my sight to a suicide attempt 6.5 years ago. So
I'm sorry. I didn't know that. And
oh,
I'm glad you're here. I'm glad we're having this conversation.
I am too. But this is why I just say that so that, you know, I'm familiar with the military world. I'm not familiar with the combat world. I thankfully did not see combat, but I a couple of things that came up there. I think one, I get as ridiculous as this sounds, I'd actually never heard in people talking about PTSD. You know, I'm around a lot of other veterans. I've had a lot of other veterans who have seen combat, being a disabled veteran, that ends up with me being around other disabled veterans who did lose something huge in combat. That is where their disability stemmed from. I've never actually heard someone discuss the fact of almost being emotionally numb to the world. It's always more so the being on high alert in that. And a lot of times survivor's guilt almost, I feel, at least on the veteran side of thing, is that is what haunts me, is having survived it. And so I thought that was really interesting, but I think it might maybe be important here because the first question that came up for me when you said this, about 70% of us will experience trauma in our lives. Mm-hmm. Is there an actual definition to what makes something a traumatic event, maybe before we move forward with the rest of this?
Yeah, well, there's controversy about every definition, right?
Always.
In general, we think of a traumatic event when I'm asking somebody, so I don't normally say, have you experienced any traumatic events? I will ask something like, have you ever experienced an event where you thought you or someone you cared about could be killed or seriously injured? And I think that that perception matters a lot. So, for example, we could be walking down the street together. We get held up. You're sure he just wants our money and is going to leave us alone. I'm sure he's crazy on crack and is going to kill us. Even though to other people it looked like we were in the same event, I'm more likely to get PTSD because I think that he's going to kill us.
Entirely subjective to how it was perceived. Okay. I thought another thing that you said there was very specifically in the idea that maybe PTSD surfaces from the avoidance aspect. I thought that was, again, something that I've never heard, but also very interesting in the context of military, because...
Want to make a difference in your community, but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
You know, you mentioned that big event and maybe not wanting to show a big reaction. It's more right. than that. Like, you can't show a big reaction. You have to continue, you know, the first thing always in the combat. Again, I realize I haven't been to combat infantrymen, though. It's end the threat. You don't do anything to render care for your own people. It is end the threat and get off the X of wherever that contact was. It is, and then it is render aid to your own. And then, you know, if the enemy have survived, you're supposed to render aid to them as well. But there's no room there to have a reaction. If you do, more people will die, maybe yourself included. And so it's interesting because you have to have that and that skill to stuff that stuff down. But then it is... I think the other side of that is very interesting is obviously the, you know, if you're mid deployment, there's not going to be room for you to then process that. And obviously there's also the mentality, especially in the infantry of, no, you will stuff it down and deal with it on your own. And the adage of suffer in silence, but it's been interesting in doing this podcast. I've had couple operators on, and specifically a gentleman who's Josh Brown. He's still an active duty Green Beret and has been for 30 years now. But he said in the SF units, they do have directed support on hand so that these guys, maybe not while they're deployed, but even like at their unit, they have mental health staff on hand and are maybe not urged to go do it, but it is accepted in that community to go seek help. So I feel like maybe that is something that is starting to surface where they are realizing that at least operators need to, after having been forced to avoid that stuff, do need to be able to have time set aside to then deal with it later on. But have you seen that start to become more prevalent in general with the veterans that you're working with, or is this still a big issue, not having that time on the back end when it is appropriate to finally stop avoiding it?
Yeah. Oh, I definitely see that. I mean, in general, the Department of Defense is paying more attention. In general, people are trying to learn from the Vietnam veterans. PTSD really came about as a diagnosis because of the huge number of Vietnam veterans that were suffering. And so I think that our modern day leaders are trying to learn from that. But you're exactly right. You can't have a big reaction when you need to do what you're trained to do. But at some point, you need to be a human and put it all back together. And for a lot of people, that's really hard to do, whether it's because you're downrange or because you're trained not to do that or because it hurts or because you're using substances to push it down.
Very, very common. Yes.
Yes. Yes. So at some point, you do need to put it back together and figure out what kind of place you want it in your life, what kind of relationship you want to that memory and to those triggers, and then go on to live the life that you want to lead.
Would you say you know, especially if like some of those deployments, especially like in the thickest part of the war, instead of a 6-month deployment, these things are getting extended out to like 15 and 18 months. So, you know, there, again, there's no option to not avoid it. Is there a, I guess on one hand, do you suspect that there is a relative time window of which that avoidance is okay before it does start to creep into developing into PTSD? And also, I guess the second half of that question will lead into some of the treatments, because it is something that is treatable and that people can overcome.
Yeah. So conventional wisdom is you have until someone sleeps on it to modify that memory.
That's it.
No, it's not it. Okay. But that's one window. That's like the first window. And so, for example, we were doing some studies in the emergency room and working with people doing basically exposure therapy right after they've come into the emergency room, once they're medically stabilized, with that in mind, that we had this window until they slept on it to modify that memory, that it'll be a bad memory, but maybe it doesn't have to be a fear memory. It doesn't have to be a hot memory. But no, I mean, we treat people that the traumatic event happened 50 years ago and treatment works just as well. So, the earlier, the better, because, and I'm speaking mostly about PTSD. Mm-hmm. Once PTSD develops, there are a lot of other things that sometimes it drags down with it. So a lot of times people get depressed. A lot of times people are using substances to try to manage their PTSD symptoms. And then that's got a whole, you know, other boatload of problems that can go with it. So yes, there's no absolute window as soon as someone can. I mean, but you think about, you know, I've heard about a lot of smart chaplains and first sergeants, you know, after something's happened, you know, doing a little walkabout and checking in with folks. And they often have a very good sense of who might be haunted by this, who might need a little bit extra talking to. But then I've also heard that, you know, one psychiatrist, when they were in, I think it was in Iraq, and set up there, and somebody wrote "whack shack" on his office. So not really encouraging people to, you know, come in and ask for help.
Yeah, that's not shocking to me at all. Yeah. It's interesting. Yeah, I had very different views on mental health and seeking help until after I shot myself. As you would imagine, that changed my perspectives on getting help, because me not getting help is what led me there. But it's that mindset, at least, you know, I've been out since 2018, but that was still very much so like the mindset when I was in. And I doubt, at least in conventional units, I can't imagine that it's probably changed that much in the time since, but
it really is changing. We're getting a lot of referrals from active duty bases, and you know, we're going to talk about the MDMA study in a little while. That's being funded by the DOD. It's being funded by the Department of Defense. Department of Defense is going to give us money to give MDMA to active duty service members. So yes, I do think it's changing.
Which is such a wild, that is a freaking wild concept to try and wrap your head around.
Yep.
But it's awesome at the same time. I mean, it is wildly awesome. So I you had kind of set, or I guess brought us up to the idea of exposure therapy before I pulled you down that. Do you want to continue down that path?
Yes, thank you. So if we think that avoidance is part of how PTSD develops, the anecdote to that is confronting and approaching. A lot of times I'll tell people, you got a gold medal in avoidance, we're going to get you a gold medal in approaching. And learning that it's not dangerous, and learning that it can change, and learning that it can get less distressing. So we do that with what's called imaginal exposure. So we, you know, basically talk about what happened. We talk about it over and over and over. And then once that initial distress can go down, then they can start to think about it differently. So, you know, for example, rather than it was my fault that Jones died because I was driving when we hit that IED, by going over it and over it and over it, they can see the insurgent planted that IED so that no one would see it. There were 8 eyes on that road. I actually did a lot and, you know, tried to help Jones, so it sucks.
Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
That Jones died, but it wasn't my fault. And that's a different way to carry that memory forward. And then we also help people with their day-to-day lives. So many folks are triggered by things that their bodies feel like it's a high level of threat, and they're really not. They're really relatively safe. But and so we help people do that and learn in their bodies that this situation doesn't pose the level of threat that my body is feeling like it. And we've been able to show that. We do. We've been looking for objective measures of PTSD, and so we'll do psychophysiological studies and looking at the startle response before and after treatment, and we're able to see that the startle response decreases with treatment, which makes me happy because it's showing that their bodies are learning to not be so reactive to these cues. Their bodies are learning it's not as dangerous.
Which is, you know, and I've honestly, I don't know that until I came across you, or I guess until your team reached out to me, that I hadn't come across this in the context of treating PTSD. I knew it could be used for OCD and some other things like that, but I was intrigued not just because of the fact that this, I hadn't heard it being applied for treating PTSD, but specifically because you invented using VR to apply this, and then specifically was like you were a big proponent of using it for treating veterans with PTSD or with their PTSD. But like I guess on one hand, that seems like
I'll stick with prolonged exposure for a minute, because it's got more evidence that it works for PTSD than any other intervention out there, including 2 FDA-approved medications. Every single treatment guideline published across the world recommends prolonged exposure as a first-line treatment for PTSD. So it is very effective. I mean, nothing works for everybody, but it is very effective.
And that would be, I guess, what's the between what would just be exposure versus prolonged exposure? Is it the repeat sessions that makes it prolonged exposure?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That we do it repeatedly, and you do it over and over and over. So that initial response can come down a little bit. The distress can come down. I mean, because if you can't even think about it, if you're avoiding, you can't even think about it, then you can't possibly think about it differently. And so by going over it and over it until that initial distress comes down, and then you can really start looking at it and thinking about it differently.
So does that begin, because like you said, even just thinking about it can make people sweat and fidgety and all these other
things.
Exactly,
right.
In the beginning, is it just okay, we'll get you to think about it. And now we're going to talk about it. And over time, then we will go, if it's okay, these, whatever the actual trigger is, then over time you start to transition to, okay, we are going to actually be around the trigger now.
Yeah. Well, so we do it faster than that. In the Emory Healthcare Veterans Program, we have a 2-week program. We bring in veterans and service members from all around the country. Everything is at no cost to them. We can fly them in, put them up at the hotel across the street from our clinic, feed them, and give them more therapy in 2 weeks than most people get in a year. And if they've got PTSD, we give them daily exposure therapy. So they meet with an individual therapist every morning. And that's where they'll do, we call it imaginal exposure. So going back in their mind's eye to the time of the traumatic event and recounting it out loud. And then we record it on their phone to give it to them to practice later on. And we go over it and over it and over it. And then after we do that, they open their eyes and we talk about it, and we call that processing to try to see what they learned, and for the therapist to help them see what the therapist is seeing. So a lot of times early in treatment, it might just be, I remembered a lot more, or I didn't remember this. And that very often happens when you're avoiding it, you're not going to think about it and you're not going to remember stuff. And then very often people will tell us it's getting easier. It's getting easier to talk about. It's getting easier to think about. And then, you know, people are really starting to look at, if very often people have thoughts like, I wish I did, I wish I didn't, you know, why didn't I? And then we can really look at that. Okay, why didn't you? There were reasons you didn't. And, you know, like you said, you know, in you're getting shot at, there are things you need to do. And the context matters a lot, so we can go through that. And we'll also start doing what we call in vivo exposure. And that just means in real life. So, for example, driving in traffic, you know, sitting with your back to the door, talking to someone you care about what happened to you. Putting on your uniform. I mean, it can be a lot of different things. And then also we want to do things that they've been wanting to do, or their family's been wanting to do and they haven't been able to do. Go to a ball game, go to a movie, go to a concert, take your kid to the park, go to your kid's game. So we put things on that list that they have not been able to do, but that they want to be able to do. And my big thing is choice. You know, I want people to feel like they've got the choice to live their lives the way they want to and not have those scales dipped already because of PTSD and avoidance.
I have about another million questions for you after that. So I guess, is that the concept of the almost could have, would have, should have in things that they could have done, things that they wish they had done, is that typically something that already contributes to the PTSD or that comes up as you're conducting this prolonged exposure?
Very often it's already there. You know, very often that's part of what's haunting them.
So it is something they are aware of, those things being there.
Oh, yeah. You know, and then, you know, hopefully they're going to tell their therapist about it, so then we can put it on the table and talk about it.
Okay. And with, you know, you mentioned not just talking to family members about some of these things, but actually going and doing things that they and their loved ones have been putting off. So do you bring families in for this 2-week program too?
We bring families in via telemedicine. So we don't have families come to Atlanta with them, and that's on purpose, because we really want people eating, breathing, and sleeping this program and their treatment when they're here, and we want no distractions. But depending, you know, if people are kind of local and they see their families on the weekend, or, you know, when they go back, we will work with them on a list and very often they already know what their family wants them to be doing, and their family has let them know. And it's, you know, just amazing. You know, for example, I heard the story about, you know, somebody on the list that finally took their kid to go get ice cream. And then afterwards, the kid, you know, kissed their dad on the head and said, thanks. And, you know, so that's going to like reinforce it right there and make you want to do that again and get out there and start doing things. I had one veteran, this was years ago. He told me moved a little mini fridge into his bedroom. He said, now I don't even have to leave my room to eat. I mean, people's lives can sometimes become so narrow. And so with the in vivo exposure, we want to help them get back out and do things. And again, give them that choice to do what they want to do.
Yeah, it's hard to understand how debilitating that can be, because obviously the people who, you know, like the people who I've interacted with who do have PTSD, you see them at least when they're at least.
Want to make a difference in your community, but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously, your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
At least at a stage where they can be out in public doing things, at least in the places that I'm meeting them. So it's, you don't see it at its worst, like that gentleman who couldn't leave his own room.
But sometimes you see them out there and their head's on a swivel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, you know, it's not uncommon on our in vivo exposure hierarchy to go to Walmart, but to do it, you know, at the busy time of day and not to pull guard duty doing it. So, you know, when people are doing it and then they're not getting bedded, we'll ask them how they're doing it. Well, I'm going down. My wife is behind me. I'm looking around each aisle before I'll let her turn. Well, they're hyper-vigilant. They're doing a lot of safety behaviors. So it's not being what we call a therapeutic exposure. And so that's what we want to teach people how to do it without being on guard, without all these safety behaviors, to really let their body and their brain see that it's not the level of threat that it feels like.
And I'm guessing if you guys have stuck with the 2-week format, it sounds like it's all basically, I mean, that's your full-time job while you're there for 2 weeks is to receive those treatments, but you're seeing that actually lead to sustained progress once they leave, even though it's just 2 weeks.
Absolutely. We're seeing huge improvements in PTSD and depression. And we follow people out for a year after treatment and they're maintaining their gains. It sounds corny, but the word we hear most often and from family members is transformative. And, you know, people tell us, you know, you gave my kids their dad back. You gave me my wife back. You know, I mean, it's really amazing. And with PTSD, it's a disorder of avoidance. And a lot of times that includes the treatment. But so I love this treatment every day for 2 weeks because we've got a better than 90% completion rate. I really think this is the secret sauce to treating PTSD because it combats their avoidance. They're here with us. They only have to make that decision once. And we, in our program, we start a new cohort every Monday. And so it's amazing what a difference a week makes. So at any given time, we've got people that it's their first week in treatment or their second week in treatment. And so it's really inspiring to see how well people are doing in their second week and that they can encourage the folks who are there in their first week and say, yes, it's hard, but stick it out and it's going to get better.
Yeah, so they're in there together.
Yes.
That is freaking cool.
Most of the treatment, the exposure therapy, that's individual. So it's a combination of individual therapy and then some group things as well.
Wow. Did you stand up this program? I know you're the director, but were you part of building this up, or did you take that on after it was already established?
Yes, I did stand it up, and I want to give a shout out to the Wounded Warrior Project because they have funded the Warrior Care Network, and that's what the Emory Healthcare Veterans Program is, part of the Warrior Care Network. And this is our 10th year. We're about to celebrate our 10th anniversary.
Wow. Congratulations. That is insane.
Yeah.
And how big are these cohorts? I mean, you've been doing it every week for 10 years.
Yeah. So it varies, 5 or 6 or 7 people in a cohort. So at any given point, we might have, 10, 12 folks on site. Over these 10 years, we've treated, I think, about 1,500 people in this in this intensive format.
That is so cool. What was it? I know you've been, you've been kind of entrenched in this stuff since the 80s. Why did you stand this up? Why this format? Were you already, had you already seen the efficacy of prolonged exposure, or was this, did the VR stuff come out of that? Was it before? How did all that play out?
All right. So I'll go through history. Yeah. So I've been doing exposure therapy for PTSD since 1986, and it worked really well. But like I said, in general, about 50% of people drop out of PTSD therapy, and that's all therapy. And it depends on the setting. In general, most psychologists will see people once a week for therapy. Sometimes in some of our studies, we would do it twice a week, but that still gives a lot of time for avoidance to kick in between. Mm-hmm. And so we wanted to create a program that broke down a lot of barriers to care. So everything is at no cost to the veteran or service member. And they don't have to use insurance or have insurance. It doesn't matter if people were less than honorably discharged, if they're not eligible for VA services, and to combat that avoidance. And then over the years, we've added services. So we've got different tracks. If PTSD is the main problem, then we've got the PTSD track. If depression or panic attacks or something else is the main problem, we've got a track for that. If people have problems with substance use or misuse, that we've got a track for that. If people are having difficulties that they attribute to a TBI, we've got a track for that. So we really try to individualize the treatment that every person gets. No two people get exactly the same treatment, because we try to give them what they need.
And that's important, obviously, to meet people exactly where they're at and what
right.
they actually, not just have a broad brushstroke program that you push everyone through to crank people through the door.
Right. So for example, with the substance use. So it is a dry program. People do have to agree to not use substances for the 2 weeks they're with us, but we'll work with people what their own goal is. If they want to work towards abstinence, we'll work towards abstinence. If they just want to work on harm reduction and reducing use, we'll work on that. So it is what people want to work on.
How common is that in terms of being a component of, how common is that intertwined with what people are going through, is the self-medicating through different substances?
It is very common in PTSD. And I remember a study a while ago just about people in Manhattan after 9/11 and tracking PTSD and depression and substance use. After a while, so the PTSD and depression went up and then it came back down. The substance use went up and never came back down. People tend to not want to feel pain, not want to feel bad. I've had a number of people say when they came back from deployment, they basically were drunk for the whole first year. And then a family member said, you know, come on, you got to do something different.
Yeah,
but it's not everyone, but it is very common.
Yeah, and unfortunately, I think that probably contributes, the substances contribute to the suicide epidemic because you're making bad decisions. I was sober the night that I decided I was going to kill myself. I was not sober the night that I shot myself. And it makes you wonder, like, would I have gone through with it? And I'm sure that's it's a common ingredient in those situations.
It is.
Wow. It's just, have you guys had other programs and facilities or universities even reaching out to you and trying to stand up similar programs?
Yes, we have. And so we do what we call evidence-based medicine. So what that means is you use something that's been shown to work for whatever you're trying to treat. And if you're developing something novel, you describe it so that other people can replicate it and you gather data on it to see how well it works. So yes, we've written manuals, obviously describing prolonged exposure therapy. And we've written a manual for this masked exposure therapy, the intensive outpatient program, because if it works, we want people to be able.
Oh, the car from Carvana's here. Well, will you look at that? It's exactly what I ordered, like precisely. It would be crazy if there were any catches, but there aren't, right?
Right, because that's how car buying should be. With Carvana, you get the car you want. Choose delivery or pickup and a week to love it or return it.
Buy your car today with
Carvana.
Delivery or pickup fees may apply. Limitations and exclusions may apply. See our 7-day return policy at Carvana.com.
To replicate it.
Which is just such a beautiful thing. Are you aware of this starting to spread, specifically this intensive inpatient approach to it?
Yes, other people have stood up programs. The VA has stood up programs. We've worked with people who want to do it, and we encourage it. Because really, I really do think this is the secret sauce to treating PTSD.
Yeah, do you think it's because it's, I guess, have you stopped and considered why that is? Is it specifically because it is like all day, every day while they're there? I know, obviously, there's a lot of factors there. Like you said, even them being able to interact with people who are farther along in the program and things like that. But at its core, do you think it's just because it is immersive?
Well, at its core, I think it's because we're delivering effective treatment.
Okay.
And then add on top of that, I think the intensive nature of it is keeping people in treatment. I think it's counteracting their avoidance. I've had, you know, before this, I had people tell me that they drove up to the clinic and then they just kept driving. Avoidance is big in PTSD. And with this, especially with most of our folks coming from out of town, staying at the hotel, they only have to make that decision once. They're here in Atlanta. If they don't show up for therapy, maybe one of our veteran outreach coordinators goes across the street and knocks on their door and says, come on. Yeah. And it helps them get over that hump.
Gosh, it has to be so cool to be there and see this like that.
It is amazing. It's really amazing. That's what I tell my folks. If you can't get joy in your work doing this, then I don't know how to give you joy. Because it really, I mean, that's what, you know, one of our therapists is like, where else do you get to save someone's life every 2 weeks? You know, I mean, it's really, it is really wonderful. And yeah, I appreciate opportunities like this to get the word out because we're not always full, which breaks my heart. Cause I know that there are thousands, tens of thousands of people who need this. And I don't want to be the best kept secret in Atlanta or in Georgia or the Southeast or the United States. I want people to know about it.
Oh, and I want people to know about it. That's obviously you as an individual and all of your work interests me, but also like I had never heard about the program until your team reached out to me, and it just, hopefully this starts sending people your way. And even I'm sure I'll have some of your colleagues on down the road, because I saw there's some other very clinicians doing other interesting things that I'll want to talk to, but it's, I know we've got to be mindful of time here. Would you rather address the MDMA study first or start delving into the VR stuff?
Let's talk about MDMA first, just because okay. Everybody's wanting to talk about psychedelics now. So yeah, we don't have to keep people waiting. So there are a lot of different psychedelics out there. The three that have been applied to PTSD most recently are ketamine, psilocybin, and MDMA. Ketamine, and you and your listeners probably know, is an anesthetic. It's a pain med. Very often it has to be administered by an infusion. And you might have heard of Spravato, which is a nasal spray that delivers ketamine for treatment-resistant depression. Most of the research that's out there is on depression. There have been a couple of studies for PTSD. There's a little bit of a question of how long the effects last, because it looks like it helps, and then the farther away you get from an infusion, you might need another one, and then another one. So there's a little bit of question about that. Yeah.
A dangerous kind of relationship going on there. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Maybe. Psilocybin, people think that's magic mushrooms. And so mushrooms have been around and used in rituals for millennia. I mean, they've got pictures of mushrooms in caves and all the, you know, relics. So people, you know, realized its psychedelic properties, its therapeutic properties. Most of the research recently has been done with depression, and it's been shown to be helpful for depression. A study just came out recently with PTSD, and it was shown to be helpful for PTSD. And we are about to start a study. So I'm going to talk most about MDMA because there's the most data about it for PTSD, but we're also about to start a study with psilocybin for PTSD. So we're very excited about that. So now I'll get to MDMA. And MDMA has been used for PTSD and received breakthrough therapy from the FDA. Now I forgot the date, in 2017, I think. And so there have been a couple of very well-controlled studies that have shown that it helps. And it's MDMA-assisted therapy. So it's not just MDMA. The therapy is an important part of it. But you may know in 2024, the FDA voted not to approve MDMA for PTSD. And part of their reasoning was that the therapy that was used was not an evidence-based treatment for PTSD. So we've been doing translational research with MDMA for about 10 years. And so what translational research is, you know, going from animals to humans and back and forth again. So we started in a rodent model and found that MDMA facilitated the extinction of fear, which is a good thing for PTSD. Yeah. We also found in that study that SSRIs, the antidepressant medication, blocked MDMA's effects. So that sucks because most of our patients come to us on SSRIs, but it's important to know that. So that's one important thing about MDMA, that people have to taper off of their SSRIs before they can get MDMA.
Is that because it plays on the serotonin receptors in the brain?
Exactly. Exactly.
Huh.
And that's one of the mechanisms of action, how MDMA works and what do SSRIs do. Selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, they block that. And so then the MDMA can't really have access to that neuron, that terminal. And so then we did a healthy human study and then finally got to the point where we're doing what we're doing now, which is with people with PTSD and combining it with exposure therapy. And this that we're doing now is it's called just an open clinical trial. So everybody is getting 100 milligrams of MDMA. They know there's no placebo. There's no randomization, because a lot of people, especially a lot of the MDMA folks out there, said you can't do it with that therapy. You can't do it with prolonged exposure, and you shouldn't. You shouldn't do it with that. Don't do that to people on MDMA.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're doing this open clinical trial first just to see, can we, should we, and then to develop the protocol. So again, so other people can replicate it. We have seen 14 patients so far, and in general, we're seeing about an 85% decrease in PTSD symptoms. It is amazing. It is so amazing. It feels so synergistic. It feels, you know, we kind of talked about like the military brain and the PTSD brain. It feels like the PTSD brain is kind of like locked down.
Yeah.
And it feels like the MDMA opens it up. It's like the MDMA gives the PTSD brain and the military brain permission, you know, to open up and then access to do what we need to do in the exposure therapy. And so it really feels so synergistic.
And again, another 74 questions with the 85% or so success rate there. What is the, as compared to your standard, just the exposure therapy outcomes?
So that leads into the next study. I mentioned that the Department of Defense has approved funding for two randomized controlled trials. And so we're preparing those now. We're not ready to enter people into them yet. But in those two trials, we will randomize to be able to compare, because that's part of the question.
Okay.
We know this 2-week therapy is effective. I mean, nothing works for everyone, but that's one of the questions. And so in one study, we will be randomly assigning people to receive MDMA or placebo plus this 2 weeks of therapy, and to see, you know, who needs it, who does it help, who doesn't need it. And then in the other study, we're going to be comparing different doses of MDMA to see, you know, which one is more effective. And also a cool thing about psychedelics and MDMA included is people have documented that they induce neuroplasticity. Mm-hmm. So it opens the brain up to new connections, new experiences, new learning. And a study estimated that for MDMA, that open critical period is about 2 weeks. So by giving them one dose of MDMA and then our exposure therapy every day for 2 weeks after that, we think we're really capitalizing on that neuroplasticity as well.
That also, you know, obviously I'm making a leap here, would suggest that that could have big implications for people with TBIs as well.
I agree.
Yeah.
We're not there yet in our studies, but I absolutely agree.
Gosh, I have so much I want to ask you about. I know we've got a 6-hour and a half timeline. So with this, if I guess rapid fire here, like I know, you know, like DMT for one is a psychedelic compound that our body will endogenously produce. Is MDMA produced in the body at all, or is this entirely exogenous?
No, yeah, it's synthetic.
Okay. With that, this, I think you said it's 100 milligrams that you're giving people?
Correct.
In terms, I understand that there's not a therapeutic dose already established, because there haven't, you know, there was only that one study that didn't turn out very well. But
No. There were the two studies, the two phase three studies were actually effective. And the MDMA plus the MDMA assisted therapy was more effective than placebo plus the MDMA assisted therapy. They just because the FDA didn't approve them doesn't mean they weren't effective. Again, it's a whole different paradigm. So they, in those two studies, they administered higher doses of MDMA, and very often with a booster dose. And they gave three doses, and therapy was over 3 months. They had two therapists for all the sessions. And in general, I think there were 42 hours of therapy over those 3 months.
Very, very different application. Yeah. Okay.
Yes. Yes. So very different.
Is the 100 milligrams the same dosage? And you are just applying MDMA once, correct?
Right.
And, okay.
Right. So the 100 milligrams is a little bit lower than what they used in the studies. But again, it's a different therapy. We're hoping for the synergy of the MDMA and the exposure therapy. And so we felt like, and in some of the studies that they've done in the past, when they compared in another study, 75 milligrams was a very effective dose. And so since we are doing this therapy when people are on MDMA, we thought an effective dose, but not the highest dose, to have people be able to interact and do what they need to do would probably be better. And so far, so good.
Yeah. So when someone takes that 100 milligrams, I know you said the window of neuroplasticity is thought to stay open for about 2 weeks, but the day that you give them the medication, are they out for the day? Like, what is...
Oh yeah, no, that's a very special day. So okay. we're with them. Two therapists are with them all day long. Our sessions are about 6 hours, and we don't let them go back to the hotel until they're not high anymore, till they're medically clear, till they're safe to go back to the hotel and be by themselves. And it is really very much of a combination therapy that day for us. We will give people the medication, say about 9 in the morning. And then for the first part, it's very much like the MDMA-assisted therapy. We'll give people eye shades and earphones and let them listen to a curated playlist and go inward. And that's part of the MDMA-assisted therapy. After about 2 hours of that, we'll invite them and check in if they're ready to start imaginal exposure. And then we'll have the first imaginal exposure session and then processing. And then we invite them to go inward again, to put on the eye shades and the earphones and go inward again. And then we have another imaginal exposure session. So we really want to capitalize on there being on MDMA. And so we're given two sessions that day.
That has to be so intense.
It's very intense. And it's really beautiful. I mean, we, you know, us and the therapist, when we're talking about what's going on, I mean, we end up using the word beautiful so much more than I have in my entire career beforehand and doing, you know, PTSD treatment. I mean, it really does seem so synergistic.
Yeah, I love that this is starting to occur both. And I've heard of some of the psilocybin research, and, you know, ayahuasca is now starting to be supported, at least in some places, for treating addiction. And I love that there's starting to be, or at least seems to be, more of an opening towards these alternative treatments that have typically gotten a bad rap. So I to use the wrong word here, I think it's beautiful that you guys are doing that. But did you get much pushback in trying to bring this study to fruition?
Oh, you better believe it.
Can you expand on that? All
along the way. I mean, so, got a lot of pushback from some of the MDMA proponents out there, that thinking the only way to do this is with the way it's been done, the MDMA-assisted therapy. Mm. And like I said, a lot of people said, don't do that. Don't make people do exposure therapy on MDMA. You shouldn't do that. You can't do that. So got a lot of pushback from that. I've been really proud of Emory. When I submitted the first protocol for the Healthy Human Study, when we were doing the translational research, I remember I submitted it, and then I called the dean and said, just want you to know that I submitted this. And he said, good luck with your work. Because, you know, I can, wow. I could see headlines, you know, with, you know, Emory researchers giving ecstasy to Emory undergrads or something, you know.
So, yeah, something ridiculous.
Emory has in some ways, you know, kind of been brave, you know, with us and approving this and allowing us to do it. The funders have been brave, and, you know, people had to get to the point that they could see that this wasn't as out there as it first sounds, and that we did have a lot of science behind it, and it was going to be safe, and we were doing it as a clinical trial, and it was going to advance treatment, and to see, you know, people were doing it anyway, but they're going underground, they're going out of the country. And so let's figure out a model that'll work for people, and especially, you know, veterans and service members, and that they can do it safely, and that we can deliver it. So when, if and when it is approved, we've got different models for different people.
Yeah, I guess sourcing now. How does that work? Is there a lab somewhere that's approved by the government to create this for research purposes, and then it gets routed to you guys?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, there. So, yes, we don't. Yeah, this is a part of the message I want to give people. What we're doing is not illegal. Because, you know, we get
that.
DEA, FDA, you know, we get all the approvals, you know. So it's not illegal. It's also not Molly or ecstasy that we're doing, because that's what you get on the street and you don't know what's in it. And ours is, like I tell my kids, pharmaceutical grade MDMA. So there are lots of very strict guidelines about any medications being produced for clinical trials.
It's fascinating. And I guess, how much longer is this study supposed to run?
We are hoping that the new studies funded by the DOD will start hopefully not too far after the beginning of the year in 2026. Okay. My hope is that we can continue the current study until the next study is open, and then the next person that calls, we can get into that study. I want to be able to continue offering this therapy if we can, until those studies get up and running, so we can continue offering it then.
Gosh, it's so exciting. And hopefully someone with some power in the administration here will hear this and reach out to you guys and be able to make sure that can continue to happen. But
well, I'll name drop the secretary of the VA came to visit us, and he is very supportive. He is very supportive of our study and of this work. And the VA has funded, not exactly the study, but they're funding work in psychedelics for PTSD. So the world might be changing a little bit.
I love hearing that. Was that surprising to you? That
he
was
supportive of it? All of it. Yeah. I mean, and like I said, the fact that the DOD has given us money to give MDMA to active duty service members. Yes. And we've also, I'm proud of the state of Georgia. The state of Georgia has given the Emory Healthcare Veterans Program a grant to give psychedelics to Georgia veterans, the psilocybin and the MDMA. So, yeah, who would have thought?
Yeah, you wouldn't think Georgia would be the place to be doing that. That is
right?
So crazy.
Yeah.
Well, then that speaks to the fact, I mean, people are rallying behind what you guys are doing and believe in what you're doing, which is, that has to feel just incredible to, like, pat yourself on the back a little bit for what you're doing. But it's just, man, I get.
Yeah, what, no, we're very great. We're very grateful. I mean, things have lined up, you know, for us to be able to do this work. And a lot of people did a lot of work for a lot of decades to get to this point. I'm very grateful.
Yeah. Do you have anything more you want to say on that before I pick your brain on this VR exposure therapy?
Go ahead. And if I think of it, I'll interrupt you and say it.
Okay. So I'm curious on one hand. I mean, it seems, I think it's great because it's, we should be leveraging modern technology for things where we can. And this seems like exposure therapy seems like a perfect place to do that was with VR like you have, but it also in me thinking about this before you and I talked, like using that in the setting of treating combat veterans PTSD seems like it could be a very fine line. Obviously, that's coming from a place of my mind running wild of what that might look like. Like, okay, are you putting these people into VR firefights?
Yeah, so let me back up and I'll tell you some of the history of the virtual reality exposure therapy. I can always remember how long I've been doing this research because we wrote a grant and I was supposed to send something to my collaborator on Tuesday and I went into labor Monday night. So I know how old that kid is. That was 1993. We got that grant. And so the first time that anybody ever used virtual reality to treat somebody with a psychological or psychiatric disorder was that study. And we did it for the fear of heights. And so we created a couple, they brought over their brilliant computer science graduate students and I explained exposure therapy and I explained, okay, where in Atlanta might I take someone who had the fear of heights? And then they went back and created them in virtual reality. And everything worked about that study. And what was really cool is by the end of it, 7 out of 10 of the people who received the virtual reality exposure therapy put themselves in real life height situations without us even asking them to. So not only did their fear come down in the virtual reality height situations, but it translated, which is really important. It doesn't matter if you can ride a virtual elevator if you can't get on a real elevator. So yeah. It translated. And so the next thing that I was begging the computer scientist for was a virtual airplane, because I live in Atlanta, busiest airport in the world, and there are a lot of people with the fear of flying. But it's a real pain if I have to go to the airport, if I have to get on an airplane, if I have to fly with them. And then since 9/11, you can't even really do that anymore. And so we created a virtual airplane, and we've done a number of studies with that, and a couple of them comparing using a virtual airplane to a real airplane, and it's just as effective. And in one of our studies at the 1 year after people finished treatment, when we were doing a follow-up assessment, 90% of them had flown on a real airplane, and it was equivalent to the virtual airplane or the real airplane. But I love it. I can exactly control the exposure to make the perfect exposure. If they're not ready for turbulence, I can guarantee there won't be turbulence. When they are ready for turbulence, I can guarantee there will be turbulence. We can take off and land as many times as we need to, all within my hour therapy session and without leaving my office. So that's actually my favorite of all of the VR applications, because it's just so feasible. You know, it makes treatment much more feasible. A lot of therapists won't treat fear of flying just because it is a pain if you got to go to the airport and fly. And so then after that, my worlds came together. So I've been treating PTSD, and then I also now was using virtual reality, but more for other anxiety disorders and phobias. And so we put it together. At that point, it was the first time anybody had used virtual reality exposure therapy to treat PTSD. We created a virtual Vietnam. So this is now the late 90s, and figuring, okay, if the Vietnam veterans were still getting treatment for PTSD at that point, they were probably treatment resistant. They probably had some other treatments. The virtual reality is a potent stimulus. Let's see if that can help. And it did. And again, we just did like an open clinical trial, you know, like we're doing now with the MDMA and exposure. And it worked. And then, unfortunately, we had another war. And so then created a virtual Iraq and Afghanistan and did that work with Dr. Skip Rivizzo, who you should have on here. He'd be fun for you. He's at USC in California. And they created the virtual Iraq and Afghanistan and the newer version they call Brave Mind. And what we do with that, it's basically just like prolonged exposure. It's imaginal exposure to their worst, scariest memories from Iraq or Afghanistan. But like an imaginal exposure, their eyes are closed and they're imagining it in their mind's eye. In the virtual reality, their eyes are open and the therapist is matching what they're describing.
Yeah.
So if they're describing, you know, driving down desert highway, Jones is next to me, Garcia's in the back, hidden IED right front, everything fills with smoke, we can recreate that. So the therapist is just matching what they're describing, and then we do that over and over again.
Well, and that's why I was asking, because it was like, I assumed that's what you were doing, but it's just, and that seems like a very fine line. And I guess it is, it's nice because again, you can control the variables there,
right.
But like putting someone back into that is just.
Well, I mean, imagine exposure in some ways, they're back there too, you know?
Yeah.
But it is a potent stimulus because in virtual reality, so people are wearing a head mounted display and it's got, it's kind of like, you know, fancy helmet goggles. It's got a television screen in front of each eye. It's got earphones. It's got a position tracker on top. So just like when I move my head in reality, my view changes. So it does in the virtual reality. So they're back in their memory. They're seeing it. They're hearing it. For many of our applications, we also have people standing on a sitting on a raised platform with a woofer, a bass shaker, a speaker underneath. So for example, you know, you can feel the explosions, you can feel the Humvee's engines on, you can feel the helicopter's rotors. So it is a very potent experience.
And this was actually something I'm very curious about because so the military uses a lot of these simulators. We used them. I mean, you can use them for basic shooting stuff, whether that be, you know, a static rifle or even static machine gun range. But they also have them, like I got sent to school to become a joint fires observer before my second deployment. So before I ever did live range time, calling in indirect fires or air support, that it was in a 360 degree simulator with all of the gear and all of that stuff. But we could also do that for convoy ops and things like that and take contact in them where you are in, it is a Humvee chassis that you have a real gunner up top. They have a 50 cal that is hooked into these, I mean, it's compressed air systems and, you know, the rifles are the same way and all that stuff. Have you guys gotten to apply this on a level like that before? Or would that increase the efficacy, I guess?
I don't think that we need to for that.
Okay.
I mean, for training, yes, you need that level that matches so much. You know, what we found in virtual reality is you want to tap into the memory. You want to tap into the fear. It's still the major work is really in the imaginal exposure. It's really, you know, working on the memory of what happened and then, you know, also your response to it in real life. So it doesn't have to be, it doesn't look like the, you know, even the games, you know, the video games, they put millions into those games to have them look like they do. And they don't need to when we're using it therapeutically, you know, just enough to make people feel like they're there.
Yeah. It's a facilitator as opposed to being the actual tree. That is so interesting.
Right.
Wow. And I mean, that's so crazy. You guys have been doing that since the 90s. Like, I never would have guessed. When I saw that, I imagined that was here in the past 10 years that you'd started doing that. Well,
yeah. Well, that's what they say, that it takes, you know, generally at least 20 years, you know, once somebody does research for something, especially, you know, medical devices or new treatments to get out into more popular use. And that's about where we are.
Wow. Well, as we bring this thing to a close, before I have you tell everybody where to find you and all those awesome things. Is there anything that I haven't asked you about that you'd like to cover here that we didn't cover in kind of brushing over these topics?
Yeah, I'd like to make sure that people get a message of hope. Because a lot of times people will say, I'm not going to go to treatment. Treatment can't help me. Whatever happened to me in the past, that's what ruined my life. You can't change that. And it's true. We can't change that. But part of what's ruining their life right now might be PTSD or depression or substance use, and that we can treat. So I really want to give people a message of hope that treatment works and treatment can help. And if you try one treatment or one therapist and it hasn't helped, don't give up. Try another one. And this is why we need options. It's not one size fits all. So please persevere and keep trying.
Yeah. And that first step, getting in the door, might be the hardest part, but it does. It gets easier and it will be worth it. You will come out on the other side of it in a better spot and being a better person for it. And
Yeah. I've met with people who before treatment told me, I don't know why I fought so hard to survive if this is my life now. And then after treatment, they said, I feel like the person I was before this happened, and I didn't think that was possible. So I can't guarantee it for everybody, but I know it's possible.
And that's important for people to hear, because of, like you said, because the hope. There is a way forward, and there are so many people out there that want to help you. They just have to know that you are struggling.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm a real believer in the resilience of the human spirit. I mean, people go through terrible things and then they live their lives in the way they want to. I mean, we're really strong even when we're feeling weak.
Yeah. And you guys are making this totally free.
Yeah.
Which is astounding. So
yeah, we want to make it easy. We want to break down all the barriers that keep people from getting into treatment.
Yeah. So where people, if someone was just emboldened by that, where can they contact you at to get on the list?
So the easiest might be just Google Emory Healthcare Veterans Program. If people want to call, they can call 888-514-5345. I'll repeat that. 888-514-5345. And if people are interested in the MDMA study, they can email mdmapestudy@emory.edu. That's mdmapestudy@emory.edu.
You're about to get an email from me and see if we can fix my blindness with that.
I don't want to promise too much that.
Yeah, I know. I'm just kidding. But.
Can I give you a plug for, we've written two books for the lay public that I'm proud of. And, you can get them at Amazon or anywhere. One is What Everyone Needs to Know About PTSD. And again, it's for the lay public. And another one is Making Meaning of Difficult Experiences. And it's basically a self-help exposure program so just putting those words out there, because a lot of people can't get to a therapist or don't want to and might want to try to learn about it or work on it first on their own.
I love that. And I'll get with your team so that I have all the links to this stuff in the show notes. I'll make sure that's there.
Thank you.
I truly just appreciate what you're doing and appreciate you taking the time to come on here and put up with my questions and tell everybody.
I appreciate you, what you're doing and helping us get the word out. Because like I said, we don't want to be the best kept secret. So thank you very much.
Yeah. And thanks everyone at home for listening to another episode of Going In Blind. Remember, these conversations need to be heard. So share them with another curious mind who needs to hear it. I'll see you next time. Bye.